1 Samuel chapter 14. For those of you that are biblically challenged, that comes right before 2 Samuel. Our message this morning is drawn from the life of Saul, Israel's first king. I titled it with a question that we have all, in all probability, either asked of others or asked of ourselves at one time or another. What do you think you are doing? What do you think you are doing? Generally, when we ask that question, what we are really saying is, have you given any thought at all to what you are doing? Or perhaps we revert to the scaled down version. What are you, nuts? What we're calling into question is whether or not individuals have thoroughly thought out a course of action or things that they have said. If you have followed Saul's story, you will remember that in chapter 14, his son Jonathan led a rout of the Philistine army. But because he had unwittingly eaten during that battle, he came under the curse that his father Saul had proclaimed. Remember that? If you remember that scene, you will come to the understanding that Saul was in the camp while the Philistines are amassing their forces against Israel. As Saul contemplates his need to bring the Ark of God into the midst in order to consult as to the best course of action, Jonathan and his armor bearer are already, with God's blessing, involved in that course of action. So Saul and the army of Israel eventually join Jonathan and they pursue the Philistines. Now Saul had earlier decreed that everyone was to be involved in fasting on that particular day. So all of the army complies. And after a period of time, because of the fact that they are weak from hunger, they begin to falter. Jonathan, on the other hand, was strengthened after he had eaten some honey that he found in the woods. And those who were around him took note of his surge of energy, and they began to kill the sheep and eat the uncooked meat. When Saul heard what was going on, he called the forces back to camp. First, he wanted them to cease from sinning in the way that they were eating, because God had specifically forbidden to eat the meat with the blood or eat raw meat. But second, he wanted to know who had initiated breaking the fast that he had proclaimed. When he finds out that his own son Jonathan was guilty of breaking the fast, he began to take some other steps. When he had first issued his decree, he did so with an oath. This is what he said. Cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself upon my enemies. So here is Saul standing before the people, and a decision must be made what to do with Jonathan. He had given his word, and again with an oath, that party, whoever it was that was guilty, would die, even if it was his own son, Jonathan. That's recorded for us in verse 39. We read, "For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die." But not one of all the people answered him. What that means is that even though Saul had made this decree a second time, and just on the off chance, he said, even if it's my son Jonathan, whoever it is, I'm not going to play favorites, he's going to die. Nobody in the camp, even though they had known it was Jonathan, nobody gave him up. Nobody said, it's Jonathan. That's what he was looking for. Somebody to tell him who it was. So what they had to do was to resort to the method that they used quite often in those days, and that was the casting of lots to find out where the guilt was supposed to be placed. And they cast lots. And the people escaped. And the two that were left were Saul and Jonathan. They cast lots again. And the Bible says Jonathan was taken. That means he was the one who broke the fast. Now that does not mean that just because God was in control of the lots, it does not mean that God was giving his stamp of approval to what Saul was doing. God was simply bringing out the truth. What exactly had happened. Imagine the turmoil that must have been in the heart of Saul, and definitely in the heart of Jonathan. But whether to save face and prove himself a decisive leader despite personal cost, or because he was caught in a trap and uncertain how to extract himself from that situation and saw no other way out, we don't know. We don't know which of those two it was, if either of them. What we do know is that Saul's actions and reactions were not wise. Neither were those actions born out of intimacy of counsel with God. He was ready to consult God as to what he should do with regard to pursuing the enemy, but he never consulted God with what he should do with regard to his own son. And beloved people, I think that's a statement that echoes throughout all of modern day Christianity. We can consult God on the big picture, but oftentimes with our own families, we fail to seek his counsel in how to deal with our children, with our spouses, with our parents. So those actions were not born out of intimacy of counsel with God. Rather, they were impetuous and seemingly self-serving. So once again, with an oath, he states in verse 44, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. Now we need to understand that it does not necessarily follow that impetuous decisions must be followed up by rash actions. Somewhere along the line, it would be a good idea to stop and consider what is actually happening. Jonathan put it beautifully on two separate occasions. First, upon hearing of the ridiculous pseudo-spiritual decision his father had made concerning the fast, he said, in verses 29 and 30, he says, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of the enemies which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. In other words, because of what Saul had decreed and because of the weakness of the people because of that decree, they were not able to go and do great things. God has in store for you and for me, beloved people, that we be involved in doing great things. But we get sidelined by someone else's rules, someone else's opinion. So Jonathan says, my father has troubled Israel. The second occasion, after his father had questioned him as to what he had done during the time when that lot was taken, he said this in verse 43, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand, and for this I must die. Now, when I read that, there are some commentators who were saying that Jonathan was just very meek, before his father. I think in this case the NIV has a better grasp on what is happening here. I think the son is incredulous. He has just come back from leading an incredible rout of the enemy. Two people went up against the Philistines, where the whole army of Saul was sitting waiting around for some divine revelation. Two people, Jonathan and his armor bearer, had sought the counsel of God and God gave them the go-ahead. Two people had put to flight thousands upon thousands of Philistines. Their whole camp was in a disarray. And now here he is standing before his father and he's about to be executed for eating some honey. And it's like he's saying, I did that. But what, are you kidding me? I've got to die for this? I don't die in battle, but I've got to die because I ate some honey? Now that's a misdemeanor worthy of death if I ever heard one. Do you agree? Thank God the story doesn't end there. Because if Saul would have had his way, he would have put to death his own son for eating honey. And finally, the people reached a point where they had had enough of bad policy, and they overrode what Saul had decreed. At least in this case, the majority appeared to be thinking more clearly than the leadership. In 1 Samuel 14, verse 45, we read, But the people said to Saul, Must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? They were able to see what had taken place. They were able to balance that out. They were, in effect, saying, Saul, are you kidding? Are you serious? Put this in the balance, Saul. This man has just delivered Israel. And you're going to kill him for eating honey. They said, far from it. And then they took an oath. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground. Saul, they said, you're not going to take his head. In fact, Saul, you're not going to harm one hair of his head. For he has worked with God this day. Boy, if that isn't a rebuke. If Jonathan worked with God, who did Saul work with? So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Glory. The people rescued Jonathan. Beloved people, that's what this is all about. God is in the business of rescuing people. What do you think this is? This cross is the symbol of God's rescuing humanity. And what Saul was focusing on was a honey-sucking misdemeanor. That has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Honey-sucking misdemeanors. What a sense of accomplishment he must have felt. And the irony here is that while Saul is dealing with a honey-sucking misdemeanor, the murdering marauders called the Philistines are escaping. The purpose was to defeat the Philistines. The enemy did an end run and dealt with the leadership. And as a result, the Philistines are escaping. In verse 37, Paul had inquired of the Lord what he should do concerning his desire to pursue the Philistines, and God did not answer him. And I think that the reason that God did not answer him is because God had already given his stamp of approval on stamping out the Philistines. Saul didn't get it. Saul was more concerned in dealing with the horror that was taking place in his camp defiance of his word. So we see Saul turning his attention to crime busting in his own army and proceeding to pass a death sentence on his own son. Perhaps I should have titled this message, Dumb and Dumber. Because that's what we have here. The dumb things that Saul said were only eclipsed by the dumber things that he was trying to do. Can you imagine anything dumber than that? With an air of superiority and a great amount of indignation, we say to Saul, what do you think you are doing? Have you thought at all about what you're doing? Isn't that what we'd say? It feels good to be right and get all indignant about wrong, doesn't it? Especially dumb wrongs like this, right? We would never say or do dumb things like Saul said and tried to do, would we? In our dreams. Beloved people, we are too quick, and too often we allow honey-sucking misdemeanors in our family to deter us from dealing with the real enemy. You see, that is one of Satan's primary weapons in the Christian church. Get people sidelined. Get them to major in the minors. And while we are majoring in the minors, our enemy is dragging our friends, our family, and our neighbors kicking and screaming into hell. Because we are too concerned about our own feelings or how to save face and to stop and think about what is really going on. Do we really think that 100 years from now, people will give a rip whether or not we were proven right or not? And if we're just looking that far into the future, let's cut it back. How about 50 years? You think people will care about the issues that you have with your neighbors, about other people in the Christian church, things that you are bowed down under, things that you're wrestling with because of your pride? And meanwhile, the people around you are continuing their steady plunge off the cliff of life into eternity. Saul was proven right. He certainly got his man. He lost the army, but he got his man. He got him dead to rights. He nailed him. He even got him to confess, only to have his victory thwarted by people who were more concerned with rescuing those under sentence of death than with vindicating themselves by condemning others. All of that to say this. What are you more concerned with? What are you more concerned with? Who are you standing with? Saul or the people? Or to narrow it down into the truth of what was taking place here, who are you standing with? Satan? Or God? Satan or God?